Well, we've tried the past two times to get through Proverbs chapter 3, so we're going to get through Proverbs chapter 3 today on our third attempt. They say, what, third time's the charm, right? So Proverbs chapter 3 is where we'll be headed this morning. We've been focusing in this chapter on the fact that wisdom itself is God-centered. That if we are wise, we will have a life, a vision of life, that is centered on God and who God is. Proverbs chapter 3, we're toward the end of the chapter. We're in verse 21 and we'll read down through verse 35. The Bible says, "My son, do not lose sight of these. Keep sound wisdom and discretion, and they will be life for your soul and adornment for your neck. Then you will walk on your way securely and your foot will not stumble. If you lie down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden terror or of the ruin of the wicked when it comes, for the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught." Verse 27, "Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it's in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, 'Go and come again tomorrow and I will give it,' when you have it with you. Do not plan evil against your neighbor who dwells trustingly beside you. Do not contend with a man for no reason when he has done you no harm. Do not envy a man of violence, and do not choose any of his ways, for the devious person is an abomination to the Lord, but the upright are in his confidence. The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Toward the scorners he is scornful, but to the humble he gives favor. The wise will inherit honor, but fools get disgrace." We've been working through Proverbs chapter 3, and the goal, the imperative that is given to us in Proverbs chapter 3 is that wisdom, being what it is, wisdom centering our life on God, makes this demand of us: let who God is change you. And stroke after stroke of circumstance after circumstance in our life is meant for this one purpose: to acquaint us with a God who is living, a God who is good, a God who is holy. And so in all our ways we are to know him. And in knowing him, he will make all the crooked paths of our life to come out in a straight line that beats directly a path to his door. It will lead us to his kingdom. It will bring us to his presence. That's what Proverbs 3 is, has been about, and continues to be about. We've seen that in this chapter, this wisdom then calls us to radically reorient our lives around God. And we've seen that this chapter has issued three summons to radically reorient our lives, rearrange them around God. The first was a call to cling to God's holy character, the holy character of a God who redeems. And this, it echoes the language of Deuteronomy. It echoes the feel of Deuteronomy. As God entered into covenant with his people, and he reminds them, "I am a holy God, and I have called you to be a holy people. Follow me, obey me, and I will bless you." In verses 13 through 20, the call to arrange our life around God looks like celebrating the gracious blessings of a living creator, a God who's woven his wisdom, his justice, his rightness into the very fabric of his creation. In fact, it uses symbolic language there of the tree of life. This is more of an Eden feel of wisdom. This isn't just the redeemed. This is the way God planned it from the very beginning. Redemption speaks of God working and reaching into something that's gone wrong. That's why we need this wisdom. But he reminds us that not only does God reach into what has gone wrong, he ordered things from the very beginning to be right. And so he says, celebrate this wisdom that is God-centered. What we come to in this section is resting then in the righteous rule of our King. We have a We have a Deuteronomy feel. We have an Eden feel. And as we come to this part of the chapter, we have an economic feel, if you will. What he's talking about is the sovereignty of God. Economics is simply the complex system of relationships that governs a people's welfare. At the bottom of the economic, or very at the top, depending on which way you want to put it, but at the foundation of the economic structure is the ultimate authority. Those who make the decisions, those who set the rules, those who exercise justice, those who exercise authority and power, those are the ones who ultimately determine the welfare of the people, the state over which they rule. Economics is ultimately determined by those who are in charge, those who have authority, those who are sovereign, him who is king. And what we see in this section in particular, this life ordered around a God who's a redeemer, a God who's a creator, we find that this God then is governing a universe as king. Now, his universe has gone wrong, but that doesn't make him any less king of it. The New Testament refers to Satan as the god of this world, and he's a usurper of God's authority. But that doesn't mean that God himself has been dethroned. It means only that he has allowed Satan to exercise a limited measure of sovereignty in messing things up for a little while as he works a bigger purpose in revealing his goodness to us. But the call here at the end of the book of Proverbs, in chapter 3 in particular, is this. Because God is king, he's a redeemer who's wise, he's a creator who's wise, he's a king who's wise, because he is sovereignly in control of life, and your life in particular, you can rest. You can take that breath. When I was trying to get things out earlier, Leviticus 9, Leviticus 19. I'm speaking quickly this morning because I've got a missions trip that we're leaving to Florida right after this morning service. My mind has been going in 15 different directions all week. We've seen people saved this week. We've seen answer to prayers this week. There's been a lot of things going on. My mind is in a million directions. What I need to do this morning is going... And as we come to Proverbs chapter 3, the end of the chapter, that's the invitation. Listen, God's got it under control. Chill. That's kind of what the Hebrew says. God's got it under control. Chill. Just ask Sarah. She studied Hebrew for several years. All right. That's the feel as we come to this part of the chapter. But we can't separate the rest from the sovereignty. We can't separate our role as citizens from his role as king. It's been said, and you're familiar with the saying, what? The hand that rocks the cradle does what? Rules the world. All right. Mom was the first one to say that, right? Okay? The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. And as you look at this little baby, so content, so why does a mom rock a cradle? Usually because the baby's doing what before she rocks the cradle? It's crying, right? His world is upset. Mom comes and puts all the world back in order. Guess what our God does? He does the exact same thing for us. Our lives are crooked. They're broken. They're painful. We're hurting. And God is able to grab hold of our world and put it in motion in such a way that he quiets our hearts. The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. It brings security, it brings peace, and that child learns to trust and then to follow the instruction of that mother. The proposition this morning is very simply this: rest in God's sovereignty. There's somebody's rendition of the throne of God that Ezekiel saw in Ezekiel chapter 1, the wheel inside the wheel, and so on and so forth. But this vision of God, God seated on a throne, lifted high above. Remember where Ezekiel sees God? He doesn't see God in Jerusalem. He sees God on the outskirts of Babylon, where his people are in trouble, where his people are in bondage, where his people are removed from blessing, or so they thought. And God shows up there on the riverbanks beside Babylon and says, listen, I'm still on my throne. I'll never forget, 3 years ago, I went to my uncle's funeral. He had two boys at the beginning of manhood, and the oldest got up at the beginning of the service, and he said, today is November 5th, 2016, and God is still on the throne. Folks, that fact alone has to do something inside of our hearts. It has to change the way we look at life. And it can. And it does, if we'll let it. Let's work through this passage, because this passage provides us three reasons that we can rest in God's sovereign care for his people. The first is this. We find it in verses 21 through 26. We can rest in God's sovereign care for his people, because his sovereign care ensures his presence to protect them. God's sovereign care for his people ensures his presence to protect them. Let's look how this one kind of filters down for us. In verse 21, we see that this presence of God is mediated through wisdom and discretion. Verse 21, my son, do not lose sight of these. Keep sound wisdom and discretion. They will be life for your soul and adornment for your neck. Look down verse 26. Because the Lord will be your confidence, and he will keep your foot from being caught. There's going to be a direct, immediate connection between wisdom and God in this section in particular, and he's been working on this for a while. That's why wisdom is God-centered. There's a direct connection between the two. Wisdom operates, and wherever wisdom does operate, guess who else is operating at the same time? Where wisdom operates, God operates. You can't have wisdom apart from God. So wherever wisdom is operative, there God is operative. James chapter 3 puts it this way. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, don't boast and be false to the truth. This is not wisdom, which comes down from above. This is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. Where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's going to be disorder in every vile practice. But wisdom, which is from above, is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy, good fruits, impartial, sincere, and a harvest of righteousness is sown by those who make peace. Wherever there's wisdom, God is at work. And so he says, my son, don't lose sight of wisdom. Don't lose hold of wisdom, because if you have wisdom, you have God. If you have wisdom, you have God. That's the point that he's trying to make here. And this presence of God is mediated via the wisdom of God. In verse 22, this presence of God nourishes the inside and adorns the outside of life. Look how he says it in verse 22. If you have wisdom and discretion, they will be life for your soul. You ever get doing an activity, you're in the midst of your project, and you're getting the job done, but you feel like you're working like a maniac, you're working like a robot, you're doing it soullessly, you're punching the clock, you're doing the work, and there's just no heart in it, right? We say, I've got no heart in this. He says, that's not how you're designed to live life. As a mother, as an auto body technician, as a pastor, as a dad, as a physical therapist, you were not designed to live life soullessly. You were designed to live life abundantly. And he says, if you take wisdom where God is at work, wisdom will breathe life into your very soul. You will have an inner source of energy. You will tap into an endless fountain. Jesus says, the Holy Spirit will be in you like a well that's springing up and giving life to you. That's the idea. That God himself gets inside of you and strengthens you from the inside out so that you don't have to do life soullessly. It'll give strength to your inner life. It will be like an adornment around your neck. The idea here is that there will be a visible attractiveness to your life that others can and will appreciate. People will look at you in the midst of your hectic, crazy, chaotic life and say, "How do you do it? How do you keep that smile on your face? How do you keep your composure when people are cussing at you and swearing at you? How do you keep your composure when everybody's wants what they want right now? How do you keep your composure when you're, whatever, when your husband has a mini stroke this week? How do you do this? You know what? I can't do it by myself. I can do this because God is here with me. God's still on the throne. And God's at work. I can't see it. I don't know what he's doing. But I know that he is." That's the idea here. And people will look at your life and say, "I want what you have. It's so weird, but it's so beautiful. I need that." In verse 23 and 24, this presence protects us even when we're vulnerable. He says, if you grab hold of wisdom, which is grabbing hold of God, then you will walk on your way securely and your foot will not stumble. If you lie down, you'll not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. He gives two positions of the body, walking and lying down. This is a poetic tool called a merism, which takes two extremes and brings them together to talk about the fullness of everything in between. When you're awake and walking, when you're lying down and sleeping, and everything between the two, God's going to protect you. Again, this kind of echoes the Deuteronomy language of when you sit in your house, walk by the way, lie down, when you rise. But he gives particular attention in verse 24, not only just lying down, which exposes us and makes us vulnerable, but when you lie down, you will sleep, and your sleep will be sweet. He says, you know what? When you lay down, why don't we lay down? Let's ask that question first. Why don't we lay down and start to take our rest? We gotta keep up. We gotta keep going, because if I stop and lay down and rest, what's gonna happen? Or what's not gonna happen? Everything that needs to get done, right? I don't lay down because I'm responsible, and the world will stop spinning, right? If I lay down. We smile, right? We know the world won't, but we feel that way, don't we? I can't lay down. If I stop and lay down, the world's going to come off its hinges. Guess what? God's been spinning this world a long time before you ever came on it. And long after you're removed from this carousel, it will keep spinning, I guarantee. So help me God. Okay? God can do it. He says, when you lay down, everything that you think you have to control, you don't have to. God can take care of it. When you lay down, he says, your sleep will be sweet. There's something that is presumed here, that you will get sleep. You ever laid down and you can't get to sleep? Because you're always thinking, oh, I didn't do this, I didn't do that. Whenever it comes to Saturdays, and then this Saturday in particular, I get in my room, I'm getting ready to crawl into bed. Oh, I go back out to the table, I write it down on a note. I get ready back in my room, oh, get out to the table, write it down on a note. Okay? And then you're laying in bed, and you're so comfortable. You say, God, thank you for reminding me of that. Would you please remind me of that again in the morning? I'm too lazy to get out right now. Okay? And he does. But he says, you know what? When you lay down, if you rest in God's sovereignty, you will be able to sleep. When you lie down and you can't get to sleep, You know why it generally is? Because you can't rest in God's sovereignty. Generally. Now, there's other reasons too. You might have drunk coffee that evening right before you went to bed. But when my mind is spinning and I can't find that rest, it's because I'm not resting in God's sovereignty. He said, you will sleep and your sleep will be sweet. It will be pleasant. It will be refreshing. It will be satisfying to your desire. You will wake up and feel as though that's exactly what the doctor ordered. In verses 25 to 26, the presence of God then protects us, not only when we're vulnerable, but especially when we're vulnerable to judgment. He says, if you rest in God, you will not be vulnerable to God's judgment. Verses 25 and 26. My son, keep sound wisdom and discretion. Don't be afraid of sudden terror or of the ruin of the wicked when it comes, because God, Yahweh, will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught. The sudden terror here is not only overwhelming, but it's unexpected. The ruin of the wicked, the implication of this is by divine activity. That is, by sovereign activity. He says, son, if you will grab hold of God, when God grabs hold of his world, he won't grab hold of you for judgment. He will grab hold of you for blessing. Right now, it feels like this world's out of control. Right now, it feels like God's got his hand off. But there is coming a time when God will stick his hand right into the middle of the wickedness of this world, and he will remove the wickedness. And the Father tells the Son, listen, grab hold of wisdom now. Grab hold of God now before God grabs hold of this world and removes the wickedness from it. Now, if you grab hold of God now, when that judgment happens, you've got nothing to be afraid of, because you've already got hold of the hand that rules the world. But if you don't grab hold of him, understand this: you can expect terror. An overwhelming, unexpected terror that's going to come when you least expect it, because God is sovereign and God will not wink or blink at evil forever. He will not allow this world to spin off course outside of his plans. So he says, rest, settle, wait, trust. Because God is with you. God is with you. You can rest in God's sovereign care, because his sovereign care ensures his presence to protect you. Secondly, in verses 27 through 30, we can rest because God's care for his people frees them to care for others. You know, it's hard to have compassion when you're hurting. Caleb sent out his update from camp this weekend. I think he sent it out last night. And he said, it's hard to have compassion when I'm constantly thinking about my stuffy nose, the fact that I can't breathe. We become so focused on ourselves that we don't think about others. Have you ever hit your thumb with a hammer? I mean, like, hard? I remember one time my dad was trying to help me put in a screw. It wasn't going into the... There were two layers of metal we were trying to get through. And it wasn't a self-tapper, and I was trying to push it in there. And so I'm holding this screw, it's all wobbly, and I'm pushing as hard as I dare. And my dad comes up behind me, and he gives me a little pressure on my elbow. No, a lot of pressure. And all of a sudden, the end of that screw gun flips over on the tip, and that bit drives right into my thumb. You know who I was thinking about right then? You know who I wasn't thinking very highly of right then? Though I love my dad dearly, okay? I hurt so bad, but I was focused on me. What God's sovereignty does in the pain of life is it frees me from focusing on me, and it enables me to focus on others. This is something that's transformative. This is what's behind Philippians chapter 4, verse 19, or chapter 2, verse 4, where he says, look not every man on his own things, but look every man also on the interests of others. How could he say that? Don't you know I've got a lot of responsibilities? Don't you know that I have a lot of needs in my life? He says, I know, but those are all taken care of because you have God. Okay? So you stop focusing on your needs because God's already got those taken care of. You focus on somebody else's needs because God's already got yours taken care of. The point is that in giving to others, it's impossible to outgive God. Listen to how Paul talks to the Philippians. He says, Philippians, thank you so much for giving to meet my needs. Let me tell you something. My God shall supply all your needs according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus. You took time to think about my needs. So you know what God's going to do? He's going to take the time to think about your needs. This comes out even stronger in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Listen to how many times he says the word all or always or every. Listen to this. And God is able to make all grace abound to you so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way to be generous in every way. This God is an amazing God. God gives me so much that he expects me to give to others. And sometimes he asks me to give to others before he ends up giving me so much. But the fact is, I can never give more than God gives me. That's why in verse 27 he says, "Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it's in your power to do it." This represents a divine obligation. He says, you owe others good. In fact, I think in the footnote here, it says, the Hebrew means, do not withhold good from its owners. They're actually the possessors of the good that we owe them. This is a divine obligation. The context is within the covenant community, and it specifically refers to one's neighbor, up in verse 28. Hallett defines this neighbor idea as a broad term for those persons with whom one is brought into contact and with whom one must live on account of the circumstances of life. So who's my neighbor? Well, it's anybody that I do life with, particularly anybody who has a need. Waltke points out that there are certain people who have needs that we are not obligated to meet. He says evil people such as the sluggard, the leech in Proverbs chapter 30 verse 15, the pampered servant, none of these are good and none of them possess a legal claim on another's beneficence. But that's not particularly who it's talking about. It's talking about your neighbor. It's talking about the one in need. It's talking about somebody that you have the ability to help. Not only is it a divine obligation, it's divinely enabled. He says, this is in your power to do. Paul asks the Corinthians, what do you have that God didn't give you? That's a fair question. Think through your possessions right now. Go through your closet. Go through your garage. Go through your home. What do you have in your house that God didn't give you? Well, everything. I bought it. No, where did you get the money to buy it? Where did you get the strength to make the money to buy it? I got an inheritance. Okay. Who put that thought in that person's mind to give you that inheritance? Everything you have comes from God. And the writer of Proverbs here is saying, my son, understand, whatever is in your hand belongs to God. And if somebody else has need of it, you become God's vehicle to give what already belongs to God to that person. You are a part of God's working in their lives. If you withhold, if you choke off God's blessing, God's still going to meet their needs, but he's not going to use you to do it. You just get to be a part of the process. And you can do that willingly, or if unwillingly, then he'll take away from you that which he's entrusted to you, and you'll be the one who finds yourself in need. But the point is that you currently have what somebody currently needs. It's the idea found in James and in 1 John. If your brother is naked and has no food, don't say to them, be warmed and filled. I've got stuff here, but I'm praying that God gives you what you need to. No, they have need, you have full. Give them of your riches so that you can meet their needs. Not only is this a divine obligation, and it's divinely enabled, but it's divinely timed. He says, don't tell them to come back tomorrow. When did God bring them to your doorstep? He brought them to your doorstep today. You ever find that God arranges your life at times when it's inconvenient? Very, very often I find that it's not the right time for this to happen. Very infrequently do I find that, oh, hey, praise the Lord, this most inconvenient thing happened at the most convenient time, right? That's not the way it works. And so he says, listen, I'm taking care of your needs. I'm freeing you to meet the needs of others. In verses 27 and 28, that means we do others good. In verses 29 and 30, it means we don't do others evil. There's a progression in this small little paragraph here. It moves from hardening our hearts in withholding help from a neighbor, moves to plotting evil against them, and then in verse 31, it talks to being violent against them. And so he's moving from bad to worse. But he speaks of doing evil in two different ways. In verse 29, he says, do not plan evil against your neighbor who dwells trustingly beside you. Do not plan evil against your neighbor who dwells trustingly beside you. He says, don't betray their trust. They're sitting there, they're your neighbor, they've done nothing wrong. Don't do them dirty. Don't figure out how you can do something to take away from them. And then in verse 30, not only betraying their trust, but manipulating your own advantage. He says, don't bring them to court. Don't contend with them for no reason if they've done you no wrong. Don't try to get what they have. Don't sue them so you can pad your pockets. He says, listen, your neighbors. What are neighbors for? Not to take, not to get, not to build self. It's to do community, to do life together. And so he says, I want you to understand that my care for you frees you to care for others. Number three, in verses 31 through 35, we can rest because God's sovereign care for his people ensures our long-term benefit. There's a warning, and there's also a promise. A warning against those who are temporarily advantaged apart from wisdom. Verse 31 is kind of a tipping point in this teeter-totter. He says, he brings it to the very worst you can do to your neighbor. Do not envy a man of violence. Do not choose any of his ways. You be a good neighbor. Like the old State Farm commercial, right? Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Okay. A bad neighbor is there too. Okay. He says, don't be like that bad neighbor who's there, who's violently ready to not give that cup of sugar when you need it, but ready to go in and take the whole bag when you're not looking. Ready to beat you up to get what he wants. Don't think that they're benefiting in these things. Don't join up with them. Why do they do what they do? They try to take control so they can take advantage. He says, you're living by different rules to this game. Who is ultimately in control? God. Because he's king, right? So, in God's kingship, in God's sovereignty, he's going to meet every one of your needs. He's going to take care of you. He's wise. He can see everything that you need. You don't have to manipulate in order to get. You don't have to violate in order to get. You don't have to hurt in order to get. You can rest. You can trust. You can give. You can wait. And he's going to go back and forth. He's going to give these warnings, and then he's going to give these promises, and they're tied into the same verses. I'm just going to work on the warnings for the first part. In verse 31, he says, "Don't be like the man of violence. Don't envy him. Don't want what he has. The man of violence is one who increases by means of force. He's the antithesis of the good neighbor." In verse 32, he says, "Because this violent man is also a devious man. He's one who turns out of the way," verse 32. The devious person, verse 32, is an abomination to the Lord. The word abomination has the idea of being repulsed by, both emotionally and viscerally. You ever have something that you tried feeding your kids and they started to gag? Or maybe you've had something like that. Just, it's this reflex. That's the idea. God says, you know what? When I see this kind of a person, it just makes me want to... Don't be that person who has to get at the expense of others. God has a repulsion to that kind of a person. He says in verse 33, "This same person, this man of violence, this devious person, is also one who is wicked." That is, one who is guilty of evil. It says he has the Lord's curse on his house. The idea of a curse is to authoritatively deliver over to misfortune. It's a curse isn't just called up by the peon to the authoritative one. The curse has the idea of somebody who has the power to impose misfortune on another, turning him over to destruction. That's the idea. And God stands in that position of authority and turns this one over to destruction. Not just himself, but all of his house. That is, all he possesses, all he values, all he counts as precious, all he's accumulated. He says, don't you understand? By taking from somebody else, God is condemning everything you get. Why would you want to hold on to that? Why would it be worth that great of an expense? In verse 34, he calls the same person the scornful, that is, one who mocks good. Waltke calls the scornful a term for extreme antisocial behavior. The mocker or the scornful is one who thinks only of himself and thinks of himself as king, if you will, who views all others as fools, and he himself sits on his throne and pompously, arrogantly determines what's right for me. As far as this one is concerned, verse 34, toward the scorners, God is scornful. God sits on his throne and he says, you know what? You're a little too big for your britches. You're really nothing. I'll have to show you that at some point. Don't be like that guy. The dad is encouraging his son. In verse 35, not only is he man of violent, devious, wicked, scornful, he uses a different term at this point. He says, this is the fool. And he reverses the order because the end of the poem is done and it drives it home. He says, really, I want you to understand, and he puts it in a place of prominence at the very end. To live this way is to live the life of a fool. To live a life that revolves around self is to live a life of a fool. And really, folks, there's only those two options, right? Proverbs chapter 3 says, live your life around God. But by the end of the poem, he says, the only other option is to live your life around you. If you live your life around you, you are a fool. But if you live your life around God, you have wisdom. You are wise. And so this father is pleading with his son, son, get wisdom. Don't let go of wisdom, because when you get wisdom, you get God. That's why you have to orient all of your life around God. That's what wisdom looks like. And the only other option is to orient all of your life around you. There's consequences, and they're bigger than you're able to pay. The promise, then, besides the warning, is the flip side of all of these verses. He says, don't envy a man who makes life all about himself and takes from others to benefit self. Verse 32, because The devious person is the abomination, but the upright are in his confidence. The upright, this is one who's contrasted with the devious person, the one who turns out of the way. This is the one who doesn't turn out of the way. This is the one who's brought then into God's confidence. Rather than being repulsed by this person, God says, bring him in. Bring him into my counsel. C-O-U-N-S-E-L. Bring him into my deliberations. But you come into his C-O-U-N-S-E-L by coming into his C-O-U-N-C-I-L. Coming into his round table, if you will. You're brought into his fellowship. And so there's this idea of being brought into this close, intimate, harmonious circle of friendship. You're brought into God's inside circle. If you grab hold of wisdom, if you stay on the right path, if you learn to live life for others, living life around God. Verse 33, he says, if you live this way, not only will you be brought into God's counsel, protected, successful, but you will be one who is righteous, contrasted with the one who is wicked. Rather than being cursed, you will be blessed, and not just yourself, but all your dwelling. We saw that God curses the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of those who are righteous. The dwelling here has the idea of more than just a house. This is his homestead, if you will. It includes his family, his flocks, his fields, even the fences that he put up. It speaks of a vitality, prosperity, fertility, security, everything that he needs to do life and to do life abundantly. He says, you have a choice. You can be one who takes and lives life around yourself, or you can be one who gives, and God will outgive you. God will chase you down with his blessings. Verse 34, he talks about the scorner, and he talks about the humble. And maybe a better English word might be the humiliated. Because this is the poor, but he's not poor by his own doing. He's poor because he's been oppressed. He's poor because somebody else has made him poor. He's poor because somebody else has taken from him. Likely somebody like the violent man of verse 31. He's contrasted with the scorner, the one who mocks what is good. And we see here that God gives this one favor. God will give those who are oppressed grace that makes their lives attractive to others is the idea. Favor. Blessing. He'll color their lives in such a way that others will want what they have. Even though they're takers, they can't get what this one has. In verse 35, again, he puts at the very zenith of the poem, the idea of folly. But in reversing it, he also puts the wisdom in a prominent position. He says, understand, the wise will inherit honor. The fool gets disgrace. You know what he gets in taking everything, in trying to grab, in trying to live life around self, in trying to be in control? You know what the fool gets? He gets promoted to be worthless. Worthless. It's like that helium balloon that goes up, 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 then pop, and it's empty. It's done. He says, but the wise man is one who is living life around God. He's contrasted with the fool. He will inherit honor, and the idea of honor is that which is heavy. Garrett writes this, both honor and inherit are laden with theological and end-time terminology, meanings. Their juxtaposition here at this point is significant. It ultimately means it's a property of God, and it's closely associated with the fulfillment of the promises related to the land. He says, at the very end of life, when this world is done, if you grab hold of God, you grab hold of everything. If you refuse to grab hold of God, what you're going to have when this life comes to an end is nothing. Nothing. You get to choose. But the time to choose is now. Proverbs chapter 3 is all about getting us to view God and to view life in light of Him. As we view God, we see that He's a Redeemer. We see that He's our Creator. We see that He's our King. The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, providing security, providing wisdom, gaining an ear. What we need to understand that we're swaddled in God's sovereignty. And as such, we can rest. We can rest in the hand that does, in fact, rule the world because He, in fact, created the world. My friend, this morning I need to ask you, are you resting in God's sovereignty? Because whether you feel it or not, God is still on the throne. Does your life look like that? Or do you look like one who has to manage life? You can't go to sleep. You have to be in control. Chill. God is here. And He's going to save the day. And He'll save it for you. Because you belong to Him. Let's pray.